for antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton, and this is Anti-War Radio.
What you get and what you see.
All right, folks, this is Anti-War Radio. Here's another song. I'll play some Ron Paul, and then we've got our first guest, Charles Goyette, coming up in 10 minutes. So stay tuned. This is Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio, 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas.
how much longer should the United States stay in Iraq?
The sooner we come home, the better. If they declare there's no progress in September, we should come home. It was a mistake to go, so it's a mistake to stay. If we made the wrong diagnosis, we should change the treatment. So we're not making progress there, and we should come home. The weapons weren't there, and we went in under UN resolutions, and our national security was not threatened. We're more threatened now by staying.
Congressman Paul, I want you to weigh in on this as well. I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, you voted to support that 700-mile fence along the border between the United States and Mexico. Did you?
I did.
What about Canada? Is there a need for a similar fence along the border between the United States and Canada?
No, because that bill, probably the fence, was my weakest reason for doing that. But for other reasons, to enforce the law was important. And border security is important. And we've talked about amnesty, which I'm positively opposed to. But one thing that has not been mentioned here, which I think is very, very important, if you subsidize something, you get more of it. So we subsidize illegal immigration. We reward it by easy citizenship, either birthright or amnesty. But we force our states and our local communities to pay for the health care and pay for the education. Why wouldn't they bring their families? And because of our economic conditions, we do need workers. But if we had a truly free market economy, the illegal immigrants would not be the scapegoat. We would probably need them and they would be acceptable. But because of economic conditions, they have become the scapegoat.
Thank you, Congressman. The other night, Congressman Paul, you ran for president once before as a libertarian. What do you say about this whole issue of church and state and these issues that are coming forward right now?
Well, I think we should read the First Amendment where it says Congress shall write no law, and we should write a lot less laws regarding this matter. It shouldn't be a matter of the president or the Congress. It should be local people, local officials. The state should determine so many of these things that we just don't need more laws determining religious things or prayer in school. We should allow people at the local level. That's what the Constitution tells us. We don't need somebody in Washington telling us what we can do because we don't have perfect knowledge. And that's the magnificence of our Constitution and our Republic. We sort out the difficult problems at local levels, and we don't have one case fit all because you have a Supreme Court ruling like on Roe versus Wade. It ruined it for the whole country.
Thank you.
That's why we shouldn't have it at a central level.
Thank you, Congressman. We can bring Congressman Paul back into this conversation. In 2005, President Bush signed an energy bill that provided billions of dollars in tax break subsidies to the oil companies with the goal of boosting domestic production at a time of these record profits. Do you believe these companies need a helping hand from the federal government?
I don't think the profits is the issue. The profits are okay if they're legitimately earned in a free market. What I object to are subsidies to big corporations when we subsidize them and give them R&D money. I don't think that should be that way. They should take it out of the funds that they earn. But I'm also, you can't discuss energy without discussing our foreign policy. Why do we go to the Middle East? You know that oil is very important about the Middle East and why we're there. Why did our government help overthrow Mossadegh in 1953? It had to do with oil. So our foreign policy is designed to protect our oil interests. The profits, that's not the problem. It's the problem that we succumb to the temptation to protect oil interests by literally going out and fighting wars over oil.
Governor Gilmore, you agree?
Yep. You brought your husband with you?
Yes. Michael served in Iraq. And we have a question regarding the government in Iraq. Everyone's talking about pull our troops out. Well, considering they've lived under a dictatorship for the last 30 years or so, what are we going to do to make sure they have a government in place before we do pull our troops out and they're able to help themselves? Otherwise, we're just putting them in a position to accept another terrorist leader.
Right.
Congressman Paul.
Well, we've had 4 years to do this, and it hasn't worked. The biggest incentive for them to take upon themselves the responsibility is just for us to leave. We don't need to lose 100 men and women every month, 1,000, more than 1,000 per year. And so you want it done. You want them to take over. You've got to give them an incentive. So I think we should immediately stop patrolling the streets. That's a policeman's job. It's not the work of the army. We're not fighting a military battle. We're in a different type of warfare right now. So the sooner we recognize that, the sooner we can make sure that no more Americans will die. We have a lot of goodness in this country, and we should promote it, but never through the barrel of a gun. We should do it by setting good standards, motivating people, and have them want to emulate us. But you can't enforce our goodness like the neocons preach with an armed force. It doesn't work. Woodrow Wilson was telling us about that in promoting democracy a long time ago. It doesn't work, and we have to admit it.
Thank you, Congressman. What's the most pressing moral issue in the United States right now?
I think it is the acceptance just recently that we now promote preemptive war. I do not believe that's part of the American tradition. We in the past have always declared war in the defense of our liberties or go to aid somebody. But now we have accepted the principle of preemptive war. We have rejected the just war theory of Christianity. And now, tonight, we hear that we're not even willing to remove from the table a preemptive nuclear strike against the country that has done no harm to us directly and is no threat to our national security. I mean, we have to come to our senses about this issue of war and preemption and go back to traditions and our Constitution and defend our liberties and defend our rights, but not to think that we can change the world by force of arms and to start wars.
Thank you, Congressman.
The president ran on a program of a humble foreign policy, no nation building and no policing of the world. And he changed his tune. And now we are fighting a war, and our foreign operations around the world to maintain our empire is now approaching $1 trillion a year. That's where the money's going, and that's where it has to be cut so we can take care of education and medical cares that are needed here in this country.
Governor Gilmore.
All right, my friends, welcome back to Anti-War Radio for antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and that, of course, was Dr. Ron Paul, clips from the third Republican debate. And I want to introduce my guest for this hour, the great Charles Goyette, my partner in crime at Anti-War Radio. Welcome to the show, Charles.
Well, Scott, it's good to be on your show. I do note, however, that I had to have you on my show in Phoenix so that I could get an invitation to come back on your show.
Oh, come on. I was going to have you on anyway.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great. And,
good.
Yeah, that's good. The antiwar.com audience is going to have a special treat today. An interview of Scott Horton by Charles Goyette and an interview of Charles Goyette by Scott Horton. You lucky dogs.
We should just think about doing a two-man show and get it over with.
Yeah, there you go, man.
There
I'll move out to Phoenix. You got lakes and mountains and stuff out there, right?
Yeah, and we don't have hurricanes, we don't have tornadoes, a lot of things we don't have that we don't want.
All right, well, for those who aren't familiar with Charles, let me introduce you to him. Charles Goyette, my friends, is America's most independent talk show host. They've called him that for years and years, and his record backs it up. He was on the War Party channel, Clear Channel, in the run-up to the war and got canned because he opposed the war in Iraq. Next thing you know, he's on Air America doing the morning show on the Democrat station. He's now doing the morning show on 1100 AM KFNX in Phoenix, Arizona, one of the most popular shows in that entire market. And I wanted to ask you today, actually, while I was on your show, hanging on through the commercial break there, I heard the spot for Dr. Laura, and I wanted to ask you, if she's such a good mom, how come her son is a sadistic torturer who brags about it on the Internet?
Now, Scott, what are you going to do that to me for? Scott, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? You're going to make, you know who else? You're going to make me an apologist for Dr. Laura? You know who else we have on the show?
Is that what you're going to have to do is apologize
for her? You know who we have on the station? We have Bill O'Reilly on this station.
Oh, well, you don't owe any apologies for that.
What about we have Sally Jesse Raphael overnight? Do I have to apologize for her, too?
She has a radio show?
Yeah,
I knew they wouldn't let her on TV.
I'm afraid she does.
Well, those people in Phoenix are sure lucky to have you, it sounds like, or the rest of that lineup.
I'm telling you, they don't know what to think. You know, we bounce, but you know, it's been established. I mean, and you look at a great market, just a little radio talk. You look at a great market like San Francisco, one of the finest radio stations in the United States is KGO in San Francisco. And, you know, they have a pretty diverse lineup of talk show hosts, and, you've got to respect them all, whether you agree with them or not, because most of them are pretty well informed, unlike most talk show hosts. Most of the ones that can't. So you got to, you know, you get a conservative, you get a liberal, you get an independent, you got a libertarian or two. You got some really outspoken anti-war guys on that station, and a couple of, Kool-Aid drinking Stepford talk show hosts, war hawks. But people will listen to radio stations and have a variety of opinions. So at least I have a small, still voice still on the airwaves here in Phoenix.
Yeah, sure. Well, and there's people from all different walks of life who are willing to listen to people that they disagree with, assuming that it's at least an honest debate. I mean, personally, I won't listen to Bill O'Reilly or Sean Hannity or anything for a minute because I know that not only are they wrong, but they're not even going to give a caller a chance to set them straight. So I'm not even going to bother listening to that. If I disagreed with you, which I don't, but if I did, I'd still listen to your show because you're an open and honest guy. You're interested in what the truth actually is, whether it fits your preconceived notion or not.
Well, I sometimes get some talk show material out of guys like Bill O'Reilly. I mean, just the other day I was running something where he was talking about, you know, when he was leading his guys in combat in war and what he would do. And I'd tell my guys this and representing, you know, that he was a full-fledged, he wasn't just another armchair chicken hawk neocon whack job, but trying to create the impression on his radio show that he was a, you know, a battle-hardened combat veteran. Some guy called him up and said, he said, Bill, you were never in combat. And he goes, okay. And the guy says, so why are you trying to create the impression you were leading your guys in this? You didn't have a gun. You had a pencil. And he goes, yeah, I was a journalist. And the caller says, well, you wouldn't want anybody to get the wrong impression. Now, you're not trying to mislead people, are you? And he says, you know, you want to be fair and balanced, don't you? And O'Reilly says, you can take your fair and balanced and stick it where the sun doesn't shine. So anyway, it's kind of entertaining to listen to some of these whack jobs sometimes.
Yeah, that is funny. He must not have got the message that the Army is now taking people up to, what, 76 years old as new recruits? You can, anybody who supports American Empire can go and join the service right now. They need warm bodies.
Well, I wouldn't mind seeing him at the recruiter's office, but I'd like him second in line, Scott, only right behind Joe Lieberman.
Oh, thank you. In
You're
fact,
welcome.
Here it is. Let's play the clip. I got the clip right here. Whoops, the music's still playing. Hang on a sec. Let me play you this clip of Joe Lieberman here. This is the most insane thing. This is from the Think Progress blog. Let's take a couple minutes, listen to this, Charles, and come back and comment on it.
And the firm this is, I can tell you, coming back from Iraq, Bob, is that you can't look at Iraq in a vacuum. What we're involved in here, as General Lutz said to our committee last week, is the Iraq is now the main front in the long war we are fighting against the Islamist terrorists who attacked us on 9/11. In fact, 90% of the suicide bombers in Iraq today, killing Iraqis and American soldiers, are foreign al-Qaeda fighters. Iran is training and equipping soldiers, Iraqis, to come in and kill American soldiers and Iraqis. So we've got to see that larger context, and that's why we're committed to helping the Iraqis to stability and victory.
Well, let me just ask you about Iran. You brought up Iran. What should we do? Because we continue to hear more and more of just what you're saying. What should the United States do at this point about Iran?
It's very important, Bob, because I didn't just go to Iraq. I went visited throughout the Arab world and Israel. And what you see throughout the Middle East is Iran in battle, basically, with us and the moderates, supplying the extremists in Iraq, Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas fighting the Fatah faction, our allies among the Palestinians, and, of course, committing terrorist acts against the Israelis. I'm not one to say we shouldn't sit down with the Iranians. I'm glad we did that in Baghdad a while ago. Well, what we did was present them with evidence that we have, that I've seen, that I believe is incontrovertible, that the Iranians are training and equipping Iraqi extremists to come in into Iraq, and they're killing American soldiers and Iraqis. And I think
All right, Charles, I'm sorry. I can't put you through any more of this. I'm about to just end it myself here. There's enough lies in what Lieberman just said to go ahead and probably spend the rest of the show commenting on there.
Well, let me do my piece on it then and make sure that we call to everybody's attention exactly the template or the model that he is invoked now and the reason that he has invoked this template. This is the lead up to the Iraq War all over again. Everybody has to remember at this point what a morph job the rationale for the war in Iraq was. How it was a shapeshifter and it kept appearing in new forms. It was 9/11. Then it was Osama bin Laden and al-Zarqawi, and then it was weapons of mass destruction. Before long, it was for the good of the Iraqi people. Never mind how many had to die. And by the way, the coalition was under strict orders not to keep account. And then it was for our own goods. We were there solely to sow the seeds of some sort of a Jeffersonian democracy. Over and over and over again, the rationale for the war in Iraq shifted shape. And no sooner had you repudiated one argument than it was reborn in a new incarnation. This is exactly what we are seeing now with Lieberman's comments on CBS this weekend with the war in Iran. First of all, the war with Iran was because of the fearsome weapons of mass destruction, the nuclear weapons. Unfortunately, there's no corroboration. The world is starting to wake up. We've got an Iran with a nuclear energy development program that is no different than the nuclear energy development program that Rumsfeld and Cheney wanted to tax the American taxpayers to pay for when they were in Ford's White House. So they have a nuclear energy development program. The neocons have tried to sell it to us as a imminent threat to the United States. Apparently that job isn't working. So it has already now, with Lieberman's appearance on CBS, begun to shift shape. Now we have to go to war, not for their nuclear program that threatens us all, not for the ICBMs that are going to deliver them to our shores because now the world knows they don't have them, but now it's because of what's going on, what the Iranians are doing, blowing up Americans in the country next door. The rationale for the war with Iran is shifting shape, and it will continue to shift shape until the bombs start falling.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that, and the reason that the debate has to keep changing is because it's all lies. I mean, you could hear, you know, I would like to give Joe Lieberman a little bit of credit and say that, well, you know, the guy is prepared to believe any negative thing about Iran, etc. But it is obvious here that he is directly lying to Bob Schaefer's face, deliberately saying things like, well, the vast majority of the deaths of American soldiers in Iraq are due to foreign al-Qaeda fighters. Iran is sending and training and equipping and Yeah. Well, those of us who've actually read books before know that Iran is not backing al-Qaeda in Iraq. It's true that al-Qaeda in Iraq is responsible for most of the American deaths, or at least the Sunni-based insurgency that's aligned with al-Qaeda in Iraq. But Joe Lieberman just deliberately, you know, smeared these two concepts together. If Iran is arming anyone in Iraq, you and I both know, Charles, they're arming our allies, the Badr Corps and the Mahdi Army. They're not arming the Sunni insurgency. So Joe Lieberman is a liar, and he knows he's a liar.
Well, I asked my listeners here in Phoenix and across Arizona today to respond in this manner. If you believe Lieberman's representations, do you believe that Iran, the leadership of Iran from Ahmadinejad all the way down to the Ayatollahs to the Iranian people are suicidal? Do you believe that they are taking actions to provoke a war with the United States? You have to believe that that's the outcome that they want if you believe these representations by the neocons. I have to tell you, Scott, I don't know any better way to frame what is going on in the world. There's that old poem by Robert Burns, the Scottish poet, "Oh, would the goodly give us to see ourselves as others see us." There's probably the best way to get Americans for once to stand back and see what we are doing, or the perception of the rest of the world about what we are doing, is Vladimir Putin at the G8 summit. Over the weekend, he held a press conference, didn't get any play here in the United States. Everybody got to see, you know, President Bush drinking a near beer and stuff like that. Nobody got to see what Vladimir Putin really had to say, but what he said was pretty revealing. He said, you've got one country, one state, the United States, that's overstepping national borders in every way, political ways, cultural ways. We're viewing the unconstrained hyper use of force, of military force in international relations. It's force that's plunging the world into an abyss. He said, are we safer or not? More people are dying than ever before, significantly four. Conflicts have not diminished. They have escalated. And his conclusion is this. It results. He's talking about American foreign policy, the Bush doctrine, preemptive war. He says it results in the fact that no one feels safe. His words, he says, this is the way he goes out. He said, I want to emphasize this. No one feels safe.
Yep. And now, you know, again, I love that example. Another thing that Putin pointed out in that speech was the brand new Amnesty International country report and all of its criticisms about American torture and secret prisons without law. And damn it, Charles, what does it mean when somebody named Vladimir, the president of Russia, is able to, with a straight face and a leg to stand on, criticize America for our human rights?
Well, you know, even to the extent the American people are psychologically immature, maybe let's be generous and let's forgive them in their rage or their psychological immaturity and their willingness to lash out blindly right after 9/11. Okay, we've been hurt, we've been struck, our leaders say we need to kill a bunch of other people, they know best, whatever they say. Rather than encountering the 9/11 event in a mature fashion, so they react psychologically in an adolescent fashion, and it's exploited by the administration for political gain. They put Bush in a bomber jacket so that he can win the midterm elections and you know, grab back the Senate and increase the Republicans' lead in the House. So if you want to be generous and you say, well, you know, not all people are psychologically mature, not all people are intellectually, and let's give the American people after 9/11 I'm sorry. But the event now of 9/11 is 5.5 years old, and you see the harvest that we have reaped from the Bush policy so far. And so now finally some sense of maturity, 5.5 years more to mature, has got to have settled in. And the American people need to, so wait a minute, nothing that they have represented has been true. None of the targets were the targets that we needed to go after. None of the excuses that they said for the war that they wanted then have held up. Maybe we need to re-examine this. Maybe instead of lashing out blindly, now we've had a 5.5 year cooling off period, maybe we ought to look a little more closely at the things they represent to us. Maybe we ought to see the world as others see us.
Nope, forget about it. You know, the polls already say if starting a war is necessary to prevent Iran from obtaining nuclear weapons, then we got to do it. And
well,
the fact,
Scott,
that this is the
right,
same group of lies again is irrelevant.
You're right, except nobody makes the other case on the national political stage to the American people. Nobody until now.
Right, Dr. Paul.
Now you've got one small still voice has begun to speak up. I had a guy, I don't know, you know, I understand what a long shot it is. You and I talked about this on my show this morning a little bit. I understand that. But I'll tell you, I had a guy call me today, and he said, Charles, when you first started talking about this Ron Paul stuff, I thought you were out of your tree. And he said, I've begun watching what he said, and I hear his appearances in these debates, and I've listened to some of the things that are circulated on the Internet. He said he's the only one who has a coherent philosophy that seems to hold together.
Sure, and it just so happens to be the same philosophy of Thomas Jefferson and the creators of this state. You know, all our traditional heroes.
Well, you got at least you have one guy voice in it now, and so, you know, okay, let the normal political handicappers, let all the geniuses like who's that guy? Every time I turn on TV I see him on there, I switch the channel.
Chris Matthews?
Well, that might be one of them. I was thinking of that guy who's a Newsweek editor, and he was in the Nixon administration,
Gergen?
The Reagan administration, the Clinton administration.
David Gergen.
Yeah, David Gergen. I mean, this is the depth of political prognostication. Every time I see David Gergen, I know I'm going to get nothing but conventional wisdom, no insight, so I turn the channel. But let me just say this. The conventional prognosticators aside, I understand that the chances of Ron Paul getting elected may be slim. But I'll tell you something else I understand. I understand that whether he's elected or not, he has already changed the debate in this country.
Absolutely. He has made already an indelible, a permanent mark on this society. I guess, you know, for years and years, you and I have wished that people would pay attention to Ron Paul and what he says. And I have to say, already this campaign has gone far beyond what I expected.
Yeah, I've been very, very happy too. I agree with you. It's gone. He's made a bigger impact already than I would ever have imagined.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question about that. It seems to me that since Ron Paul has made such strides so far in the campaign, and you know has doubled and tripled his fundraising and his YouTube subscribers and all these things, how do we take the next step? How do we get Ron Paul famous, where everybody in America, most of whom are not going to start paying attention to presidential politics for another 6 months at least, or maybe another year and a half, how do we get them to know Ron Paul's name? How do we make Ron Paul a famous public figure in this country?
Well, I'll tell you what I think that it has to do with, and I'm just guessing, I don't pretend any expertise, but it has to do with really the antidote to a lot of our modern ills. And one of those antidotes is decentralization. Decentralization of power, decentralization of media, decentralization of our intellectual life, our educational institutions, and so on. And I think that with the Internet, we have the prospect of seeing the first highly decentralized presidential campaign in the country. Do you know, this? I believe, and I've known several of the people that are at the top of the Ron Paul campaign organization, the formal organization, as you have, and have spoken with them and had coffee with them and so on and so forth. But I believe that there's something new going on, which is a grassroots prairie fire going on in the Ron Paul campaign. We have guys, Scott, here in Phoenix that are not involved with the campaign. They don't check with the national headquarters, but they're out there making stencils and making signs in Phoenix, Arizona, that showed up first in Phoenix, Arizona. Just an independent bunch of guys that they don't have to report to the FEC. They're American citizens. They spend a few bucks spray painting a sign. Who's going to stop them, right?
Right.
What bureaucrat has control of their free speech? So just some independent guys that want to do. They started making signs here in Phoenix, Arizona. The next thing you know, the signs started showing up in other primary states. I saw in the New Hampshire coverage, I saw some of their signs there. And so it seems to be a highly decentralized sort of a campaign in the making. And boy, howdy, is that what can that's what can topple the old moribund, arthritic, institutional style of campaigning.
Sure. And, you know, even going back to 2004, we saw that Howard Dean, by the time of the Iowa caucuses,
right.
Howard Dean, who was a grassroots candidate, he was not the establishment's pick. He was the grassroots candidate. And by the time of the Iowa caucuses, he had raised more money than anyone else.
Yep.
So we'll see if we can turn all this online support into for Dr. Paul into actual financial support, like what happened in the case of Howard Dean. But you're never going to catch Ron Paul yelling "Yeehaw" or whatever, you know, into the camera like Dean did.
Yeah,
he's never going to give him a moment like that.
I'll tell you something. I've watched all of his public appearances that have been available, and I've known him since sometime in the early '80s, and I have a great sense of confidence and so on in his good judgment. When he gets posed with what's clearly an "I gotcha" question, somebody trying to do him in, I've got my own idea, my own thoughts about how is best for him to handle it, how he diffuses when they're trying to trap him on something, and yet time after time he just handles it in his own way with his own integrity and his own honesty, and he does just fine. So he's not a flashy guy. He's not Mr. Slick. He's, he doesn't have Mitt Romney's voice or Taylor and so on. But I think at some point the American people got to say, quit giving us Mr. Slick. We've had all these packaged phonies. Can we get a real human being for a change who has a record of consistently representing a coherent, set of identifiable, understandable principles that are at the root, the foundational principles of the country.
Right.
I don't know, Scott. I think if it weren't for the internet, I wouldn't say that it could happen, but something is clearly happening. There's another component of this. You know, people think, well, you know, if he doesn't have the big poll numbers, and we do surveys, and this group, Zogby's, and this and that, and AP Ipsos polls and stuff, but you know, the people that control the political process at the grassroots, and particularly in primaries, are not the masses. Most people don't even vote in primaries. It's the active. So I look around and I go, okay, Ron Paul has an army of people. He has a constituency that in every state of the union. Does Huckabee have a constituency in Texas or California or Oregon or North Dakota? Hell no.
Hell no.
Any of these guys have a constituency anywhere else? No, Ron Paul has a constituency in every congressional district in this country, and you can tell by the internet activities and the support groups and the meetups and stuff that they are an active bunch, and it's activists that control primaries, activists that turn out
right.
and vote in primaries.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. Can anyone name, does anyone in Congress or any of the rest of these candidates literally have a constituency in every congressional district in this country like Ron Paul does? I mean, what you say is not hyperbole. I mean, that is a fact. There is not a county in this country that doesn't have someone who absolutely loves Ron Paul and is dedicated to helping spread his message.
Yeah, the Republican Party establishment keeps wanting to deliver up party hacks. They want to give you guys like Bob Dole. And so Bob Dole goes out into the heartland and he campaigns in venues all across the country, and he talks the talk of an inside policy wonk. Well, we invoked cloture on that vote. You go, what? You're going to tell that's going to stir love and admiration in the hearts of men. That's going to get their hearts pounding that you invoked cloture on some obscure vote. Who cares?
Yeah.
Talk to us about the fundamental principles that made America prosperous. The fundamental principles of America freedom, and that's what Ron Paul's talking about. So. We'll see. I know I'm in danger of overstating the case, but you know, Scott, it's only because of my enthusiasm, your enthusiasm, and
yeah.
the enthusiasm of others.
Well, I appreciate it. And look, we can both be realistic and optimistic at the same time. I mean, there's no reason to set ourselves up for, you know, terrible disappointment, but there's also no reason to be naysayers when this thing is taking off so much better than you or I could have hoped. And you know, when you talk about the message, the principles of liberty that the country was founded on, what's really important in presidential politics, or really all politics, is also it's just the character issue. And I think you can just take a look. This is what they said about the Bush-Gore race, right? Who would you rather drink a beer with? Or when it was Dole versus Clinton, who would you let babysit your kids? Would you let Bill Clinton anywhere near your kids? And so this is the kind of thing that I think we can put this kind of test to Ron Paul, too. Would you trust Ron Paul if you had your kids or your grandkids and you had to run out in an emergency? Would you leave him with Dr. Paul? Hell yeah, you would. He's a baby doctor, man. And would you like to sit down and drink a beer with him? I sure would.
Well, I'll tell you this, though. We need to be prepared for the inevitable slime job, because the more success he has, the more certain it is that they're cooking up a slime job on him. And, you know, you don't have to be guilty of any offenses. You don't, you know, I mean, you know the old stories. There are cognates, there are equivalents in modern politics of saying, you know, so-and-so is a thespian. He's a known thespian. I mean, mm-hmm. It doesn't matter what the charge is, as long as it's hurled with enough frequency and invective, and it'll stick in the minds of the Stepford Kool-Aid drinking American Bush supporting electorate. So the slime job has got to be coming, Scott.
Yeah, well, and we've got to be prepared for that. I don't want to name them now, but I already know what a couple of these smears are, and I already know how to handle them. So.
We ought to get you plugged into the campaign.
Well, I'm not gonna quote Bush saying bring him on or anything like that. But the fact of the matter is, they don't really have anything on Dr. Paul. You're right. They can smear him by calling him a thespian or a obstetrician
well, yeah,
or something.
Well, yeah, he's a practicing gynecologist. What kind of man would do that?
Yeah, 4,000 babies. He's dangerous. All right, so let me ask you something. I want help with something here, Charles, that I think that you can explain to me probably as good as anybody else. You say you've known Ron Paul since the early 1980s. Obviously, well, I know this from what I know of your background and so forth. A big part of the reason that you're such a big Ron Paul fan is because of the arguments that he makes about money and about what it means for our country to be borrowing billions and billions of dollars every single day from China, from the American people, printing money out of nothing. And I know this is a concern of yours. I know that you understand these international money markets and all these kinds of things. So help explain to me and to the people out there in the audience, Charles, what's Ron Paul talking about when he says that we're headed towards a financial crisis if we don't get our financial house in order here?
Look, he is the only candidate on the Republican side or the Democratic, for that matter, that really has a grasp of these economic issues or is willing to confront them. And I guess, you know, we've reverted from time to time in our conversation this morning, talking, Scott, about the founders. You invoked the name of Thomas Jefferson, and we talked about our founding documents and so on. Look, let me just, I mean, how about the simplicity of the concept that a penny saved is a penny earned? You have Republicans, you have a succession of presidencies now, a succession of presidents that have urged for the numbers to look good for the next election, and there's always a election right around the country, have urged the American consumers to go out and spend. And because, you know, the consumer spending is two-thirds of the economy, we need the numbers to look good through the election in November. And so there is no more of the belief that a penny saved is a penny earned. But I'll tell you, you can't have capitalism without the formation of capital. But America, at the direction of our leaders, Republicans and Democratic, has become a debtor nation. And I don't mean just on a political level. It's true that the political institutions have unfunded liabilities of somewhere in the range, nobody even really knows, but somewhere in the range of $50 trillion that will never be paid. But the American people have taken the lead and have become borrowers instead of savers themselves. And, you know, I don't think you need to have a Wharton MBA to understand that a country cannot spend its way to prosperity. But you only have one person up there who's saying as much. I've told my listeners in Phoenix, I put it this way, anybody from any party that comes to you in any forum and promises you or offers to give you something, you have to vote no on that person, because that person is willing to indebt your unborn grandchildren to pay for the promises that he's making for you. You've got to vote. Anybody who offers to give you anything, unless it's Michael Bloomberg and he says, here's my own $1 billion, I'm going to open up my account and give it to you out of my own personal wealth. So, I mean, Ron Paul is the only one that's talking fiscal sanity to the American people. I mean, literally the only one.
And what he says is, I've heard him say this a couple of times in the campaign so far, is that because the world continues to accept the dollar as though it's still based on gold, that basically we have the privilege, so-called, to basically print gold, that the rest of the world will keep accepting our dollars up to a certain point. And this seems to be his big fear, is that at a certain point, the central banks of the world are going to decide that the dollar is dropping too fast, that it's not a good investment, and they're going to dump their dollars and invest in euros instead. And then at that point, we're going to have massive inflation because there are untold vaults full of $100 bills all over this planet. And when all that paper comes back, we're screwed.
All of those bills, all of those paper dollars represent a potential claim on the goods and services of the United States, the property, the goods and services of the United States. And as they come flooding back, you will see you'll see America begun to be owned by foreigners. But more so than that, you'll see your savings, the value of your savings, eroded to nothingness. Economic calamity always represents an avenue for the centralization of power and authority. We get a strong man on a white horse that will lead us out of the calamity that they themselves have created. But I'll tell you, it's not something that's going to happen. It's something that's happening before our very eyes. I mean, just We were talking about Vladimir Putin at the G8 meeting. Vladimir Putin is talking to the rest of the world, and the rest of the world's already on the same page with him, saying we need a new international monetary order. What they are saying is the United States is unreliable fiscally and a danger astride the globe as well, and we need to find alternatives to the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency for international trade. It's happening before our very eyes.
And if there is an alternative, it's what, the euro or the yen?
Well, I'm not sure. I think ultimately, it's going to be a commodity replacement. I don't know that there are enough euros to we can begin to phase out, but it could be a basket of currencies, commodity currencies, or some other things.
Well, what do you think of the theory that part of this imperial war in the Middle East is to, part of all this regime change and so forth, is to make sure that oil sales continue to be denominated in dollars?
Well, it's an interesting argument. I'm not sure that's it. Look, I'm willing to accept the representation. The American people don't really know. I don't think anybody really knows all the real reasons why we went to war. But I will tell you this. There was this strange, almost astrological alignment of various coalitions that all came together at the same time. There were people that wanted the war because they said it would be good for the economy. I mean, I can tell you, William Seedman, or Larry Kudlow. Oh, yeah, it'll be good for the stock market. There were constituencies like that. There were people that really believed in American hegemony and American imperialism that came together for it. There were people that wanted it for the oil. I mean, I have in my files, you probably do in yours, the letter from these neocon whack jobs to Clinton, encouraging him to invade Iraq for the oil. You had the constituencies that thought a war would be good for Israel, for a greater Israel. They've all come together at one time, and some were used by others, and others were used by some of their prior ones, and they all came together in one big, happy coalition. And that was the coalition. It was the coalition of people that wanted war for a variety of different interests. I mean, I will tell you that I believe that Karl Rove had no deeper desire. It wasn't for Karl Rove. It wasn't about oil. It wasn't about the dollar or the threat to the dollar, pricing of Iraqi oil or Middle Eastern oil. All it was for Karl Rove was the midterm congressional election.
Mm-hmm.
Let's dress this guy up in a bomber jacket. He pulls 15 points higher. But you had them all come together on the same page at the same time in the same place for the unlikely objective of creating a war on false pretenses.
Well, so maybe there's hope there that we won't be able, or they won't be able, to start a war with Iran, since it seems like there are many fewer members of that coalition this time around.
Well, I'm not going to breathe easy about that until sometime in January in 2009, if even then. Look, Buchanan said that pretty well, I thought, Scott. He said, you got two headstrong leaders. You got Ahmadinejad, who is clearly always trying to stir stuff up and get some domestic political attention and rabble-rouse with the people that put him in office. And you've got Bush. You've got two headstrong leaders, and you have a confrontation with the United States and Iran that, to all appearances, seems to be inevitable, and you know that the outcome will be a flaming disaster.
Absolutely, yeah. Zbigniew Brzezinski has gone in front of the U.S. Senate and testified that this has got to be stopped. We're going to own all the land between Israel and India, and we can't do it. And in fact, in a speech he gave last week, Jimmy Carter's former national security advisor, the Democratic Henry Kissinger, basically, in a speech last week, Brzezinski said he's fearful that Al-Qaeda will stage a false flag attack and make it look like Iran was behind it, because they want to give Cheney the excuse to go to war. And he said not only is he concerned that that's the case, but that he believes that Congress must move immediately to rewrite the War Powers Act and restrict the power of the president to respond to a false flag attack like that. And I got to tell you, Charles, when Zbigniew Brzezinski is talking about restricting the war powers of the president in order to stop the next one, there's some serious concerns at some very high levels.
Well, I agree with you. I've got a serious concern, as does Brzezinski, about it, as do you, as do many of our listeners and the people that visit antiwar.com. I think, rather than hoping to get the War Powers Act rewritten, which would certainly be welcome in my view, I think that the first best thing that Congress can do is to rescind the so-called, the rather transparent, thin, and unconstitutional authorization that Congress voted for Bush in 2002, because he will rely on that document to further the war with Iran, and they've suggested as much.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to come back to, I think you played a Ron Paul clip before I came on with you. I want to come back to that, to watch these guys in debate and to stand up like serial madmen and talk about, you know, a nuclear attack on Iran, one right after the other. Upon what meat doth these our candidates feed that they have grown so war-crazed? And finally, Ron Paul stands up and he says, look, do you understand what these people are saying? These people, one right after another of these guys, they're up here talking about a nuclear strike on a country that has no hasn't threatened us, hasn't harmed us, has no capability to attack us. Do you understand the madness that we have descended into? America, we need to wake up to this.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I'll tell you what, too. If we do, I believe still, Charles, that we can have that effect. You talked about rescinding the war authorization from 2002. Well, Ron Paul and Neil Abercrombie have a bill that does just that on the House floor right now. And not only do I believe that the American people can force Congress to do what they want, I can prove it. It just happened last week when the Democrats and the Republicans came together with this immigration bill, and the grassroots picked up their telephones, picked up their email machines, and said, hell no. And it was dead. And why? Because congressmen are individuals, and they're interested in one thing more than anything else, retaining their own power. And so when threatened with losing their jobs, they all did exactly what their constituents demanded. And if we could all just get our act together about this war, we could do the exact same thing there.
Well, the American people, thanks to your efforts, those like you, and actually none more effective than antiwar.com. I'll tell you something. I don't know what I would have done over the years without the resources of antiwar.com. I don't know how I could, as one man, have researched and dug up all the stories and read all the news to identify the ones that were important that I needed to know about the way that they have done. But it's having an effect. The American people are waking up. I guess, Scott, that it's just a race against time to see whether enough people can be stirred, can come to their senses, enough people can be exposed to Ron Paul's message and the clarity of it in time, at least to hobble this madman before he starts another one of these elective wars.
Yeah. Well, we sure are happy to have you as part of the family at antiwar.com, and I at least sincerely believe that the more Charles Goyette shows we can put out there, the less likely it is to have the next war, the more likely it is that Ron Paul's support can be built. So,
well, it's been my great pleasure, and I mean it, my really great pleasure to be a part of the effort, and I'm very grateful to you too, Scott, for putting the whole thing together.
Well, thank you. Charles Goyette, everybody. He is the most independent talk show host in America. He hosts the morning show on 1100 AM KFNX in Phoenix, Arizona. Thanks very much, Charles.
Thank you, Scott. Good talking to you.
What's the most pressing moral issue in the United States right now?
I think it is the acceptance just recently that we now promote preemptive war. I do not believe that's part of the American tradition. We in the past have always declared war in the defense of our liberties or go to aid slave. But now we have accepted the principle of preemptive war. We have rejected the just war theory of Christianity. And now, tonight, we hear that we're not even willing to remove from the table a preemptive nuclear strike against a country that has done no harm to us directly and is no threat to our national security. I mean, we have to come to our senses about this issue of war and preemption and go back to traditions and our Constitution and defend our liberties and defend our rights, but not to think that we can change the world by force of arms and to start wars.
Thank you, Congressman. Strike while the iron is hot. They won't get off a shot. Go up on some spaces, take the all-American race.
All right, Charles, welcome back to the show. This is Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. Phone number here is 646-6446-646-6446. If you're listening live on the internet from out of town somewhere, the area code is 512. That's 512-646-6446. And again, I am Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. And boy, I really like that guy, Charles Goyette, man. What a great guy. And I sure am proud to have him as part of Anti-War Radio at antiwar.com. And if I can just echo his sentiments there about antiwar.com, I was a big fan of the site long before I worked for them. And he's right. It would be basically impossible for one man to be able to compile the information necessary to do an adequate job of debunking the lies of the war party without antiwar.com. I don't know where I would be without it. It's updated all day long, every day. And it's got every important news story from all around the world. And, you know, Goyette is right. You could not hear or see or read about Vladimir Putin's press conference unless you went to the foreign papers or antiwar.com. You go to antiwar.com and you can find the link to Putin's press conference. Why? Because it was published in some newspaper you can't pronounce in the Middle East somewhere. And what does that tell you about the United States of America and the position that we're in right now? When the president of Russia gives this giant press conference where he says all these important things and the media in America blanks it out. What the hell, ABC News? Who do you think you are, Pravda? This is America. This is the kind of thing that we used to make fun of the Russians for. God, would you get a load of those Russians? Their media full of such liars and censorers that they don't even get to know the truth over there. Look at the Russian paper. Look what they're telling the people instead of what really happened. Look at Pravda. Look what stories are not in here. Free people in the United States of America used to get guffaws off of observing Russian media. And now look at us. Look at us. You gotta go to papers from the Middle East to read about Putin's press conference? We might get one soundbite on TV, if that. One sentence in the Washington Post. But nowhere a transcript. And so you go to antiwar.com and follow the link to some paper you can't pronounce in the Middle East. Sorry, but that ain't right. It's not okay to turn America into the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. It's not okay for ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, Fox, and the rest of them to act like Pravda in censoring information from the American people. You know what it was that Putin said that you did not here on the TV news or on the radio? What he said was, what the hell are you guys doing putting a so-called missile defense system in Eastern Europe? He said, this is an aggressive act. This is part of your nuclear warfare system, and you're putting it in Europe. We removed our nukes from Europe. And now Bush wants to put his so-called missile defense system, which is no such thing at all, but in fact simply a welfare check for people who are already millionaires, and he wants to put it right on the doorstep of the Russians. And in the name of protecting Europe from Iran? Again, this is a comment I made to Gareth Porter the other day. I would like some lies that are at least credible. I would like some lies that don't shatter into a million pieces the first time you pick them up and bounce them off the truth. Iran doesn't have three-stage missiles, guys. Oh, goddamn, that was the end of the argument.
That was the end of the argument. Iran cannot deliver any sort of warhead at all to Europe, period. Period. They can't. Their missiles do not have the range to hit Europe. So, when America says it's putting anti-missile missiles in Eastern Europe to protect from Iran, they are liars. And what Putin said was, look, man, you guys wanted out of the ABM treaty, and we told you, please don't do it. You know we're going to have to react. You guys start building your missile defense. We're going to have to start improving our missiles. Please don't do it. But, okay, we're friends. We're not enemies. Go right ahead. Fine. Do what you got to do. So Bush removed America from the anti-ballistic missile treaty and began setting up his welfare for millionaires system, otherwise known as SDI, Star Wars Missile Defense Shield. And the Russians have done exactly what they said they would do, which is improve their missiles. So now that they can launch more warheads from a single rocket. Great. And meanwhile, the Strategic Defense Initiative, or whatever it is they call it now, the Star Wars program, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. It's really, really, really hard to shoot a bullet with a bullet. The only times they've had anything that they can call a success for a test have been the times where the missiles were all pre-programmed to arrive at a certain time and place exactly when they were supposed to. And even then, they fail most of the time. But Putin called Bush's bluff. Putin said, oh, this is to protect from Iran, huh? Okay, well, I'll tell you what. How about we put the radar station for this thing in Azerbaijan? And how about we make Russia a partner in the Strategic Defense Initiative? Let's all just work together. And of course, by calling Bush's bluff, he exposed him for the liar that he is. If his interest, again, as Putin pointed out in the press conference, if his interest was in protecting Eastern Europe from Iran, well then putting a radar station in Azerbaijan seems like a pretty good idea. His hesitation proves that his stated motivation is a lie. George Bush's hesitation. We are in deep trouble. The goddamn Republicans are picking a fight with Russia. With Russia. You know, my biggest fear when Bush took power, and especially after September 11th, was, oh, here we go. Now Russia's going to join NATO. Thesis, antithesis, synthesis, right? Now we're going to join up with our former enemy to fight our new enemy in South Asia. And yet the opposite has happened, and it's even worse. They're trying to start the Cold War back up. Go to Google News and type in Cold War and see how many results you get. How many newspapers around the world are saying, oh my God, it looks like a new Cold War brewing between America and Russia. Well, why is that? It's not because Russia is an aggressor. It's not because the Russian military is going beyond its borders, massacring people on the order of, oh, 600,000 or 700,000 people, like what has happened in Iraq. It's America. It's the United States of America that's acting like the Soviet Union, not Russia. And here we are. I'm not saying we're marching to war, but we're at least, you know, marching into deepened conflict with the former Soviet Union. And for what purpose? For what purpose? You know, I read to you an article here by Pat Buchanan a week or two ago. Pat Buchanan, who wrote speeches for Nixon. Pat Buchanan, who still says we could have won the Vietnam War if only. Pat Buchanan, who is not the biggest fan of the Russians in the world, has written two or three articles saying, what the hell? What would we do if Russia was treating us this way? What if Russia had won the Cold War and came in and bought up all the governments of South America and of Canada and put their missiles and their anti-missile systems in countries surrounding the United States, made deals with Mexico to sell their oil to China instead of to us, etc., etc. when Pat Buchanan is defending Russia from the imperialism of the United States of America, we have a problem. We have a serious problem. I don't know who to talk to about this. I guess I want to try to get Alan Bach on the show. He wrote a great article about it called What's Up with Putin that's on antiwar.com right now. Yeah, maybe I should try to get Pat Buchanan on. But, you know, don't you remember 1991? 1989, the fall of the wall, and then, you know, the end of 1991, Christmas 1991, when the Soviet Union ceased to exist. Now, finally, that nuclear sword of Damocles, as John Kennedy called it, was finally taken from over our heads. We thought we could return to normalcy, like after World War I. Nope, we're a hyperpower now. That's right, Scooter Libby and Khalilzad, Zalmay Khalilzad and Dick Cheney, they think we ought to take over the whole damn world and kill anyone who stands in our way. They think we ought to go over to Russia and kick them while they're down. Support the thieves known as the Russian oligarchs who came in and looted all their industries and stole all the money, all the wealth out from under them. Yeah, that's what we ought to do to Russia. Kick them when they're down. No point in trying to be friendly. And look, I'm not advocating that they're brought into NATO. I'm not advocating that we share a missile defense system with them. I oppose entangling alliances. I want America to be friends and trading partners with Russia, not allies. And for that matter, I want America to be friends and trading partners with Latvia and Estonia, not allies. Can you tell me with a straight face that you would think it was okay for people in your family to have to go die because a war breaks out between, Latvia and the Czech Republic or something? What if the Russians start up the war in Crimea again? Are you ready to send your loved ones to go die for that? This is the situation we're putting ourselves in with all this NATO expansion. And, you know, I'll refer you again to the great article by Richard Cummings in Playboy magazine from, forget if it was February or March. It's available online. It's called Lockheed Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. And it's about how the only reason that they expanded NATO was to steal money from you. That was why they expanded NATO, was to steal money from your family and give it to the stockholders in Lockheed Martin Marietta. That's why. Welfare for people who are already millionaires. You might have heard of Lockheed. Makers of the completely and totally unnecessary F-22 and F-35 joint strike fighters. This is nothing but welfare. And here's the scoop. Richard Cummings tells the story in Lockheed Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. They said, listen, we've got to figure out a way to make the American people give up their hard-earned money and give it to us. I got an idea. Let's expand NATO. And as part of the deal for the new countries who join NATO, they'll get a bunch of Lockheed products paid for by the American people. Sounds good. Okay, now what excuse do we have for that? And it was then that Lockheed set up a group to study and try to figure out excuses for expanding NATO. Lockheed set up the committee. Huh, we gotta try to come up with excuses for why we're expanding NATO. That's that military-industrial complex that Ike Eisenhower warned us about. That military-industrial complex that Ike Eisenhower helped create. That military-industrial complex that Ike Eisenhower warned us after it was too late. We should keep our eye on. Remember that? On the last day of his time in office? Was it January 19th, 1960? Like Eisenhower came out and ended his speech by saying, oh yeah, by the way, the millionaires and billionaires whose entire livelihood is dependent on America's permanent state of warfare overseas, yeah, you might want to look out for them. Yeah, it seems they have an incentive to keep America in a state of war. And, you know, if Ike Eisenhower wasn't the wonderful politician that he was, he would have ended the Cold War. He would have announced the end of the Cold War at the end of the war in Korea and said, forget this, we're dumping our planes and tanks in the ocean, we're taking our nuclear missiles apart, this is a bunch of bullshit. The only reason we have a Cold War is because the defense industries that were built up to fight World War II didn't want to go away. And so they lobbied to have a permanent state of war. That is the military-industrial complex I've been overseeing for the past 8 years. That's what Ike Eisenhower coulda, shoulda, woulda said, but instead waited till his last day in office to say, by the way, it's too late, you'll never be able to stop them, the next president after me, they will shoot him in the face. In front of everyone. In broad daylight. Because they are not giving up their power. That's what he could have said, Ike Eisenhower, but at least he left us the speech on his last day in office when it was too late, when he'd done absolutely nothing to restrain these people. At least he gave us the warning about the military-industrial complex. Me? If I could go back in time? To the Republican convention of 1952? I'd have picked Bob Taft. If Bob Taft had been the president of the United States instead of Ike Eisenhower, there wouldn't have been a military-industrial complex to give a speech about by the end of his two terms in office. But thank your grandfather for screwing you over and electing Ike Eisenhower the war hero instead. That's why your cousin got his legs blown off in Iraq. Remember to say thanks, Grandpa. I like Ike. That's a pretty convincing slogan, isn't it? Well, did you hear the way Ike and like rhyme? Here's Bob Taft on Meet the Press. From May 28th, 1950. And check this out. Meet the Press, they actually used to have reporters on there instead of Tim Russert. They would have journalists, more than one, and get this, I know this is going to freak you out, the show's called Meet the Press? Well, the way it used to work was, they would have the press come on and ask questions. Holy crap, right? Meet the Press? And just listen to the tone of voice, and of course these are the world warrior, FDR-loving journalists who are asking all the questions to Bob Taft. But just listen to the tone and imagine waking up on Sunday morning, turning it to Tim Russert and hearing reporters actually willing to speak to politicians in this manner, to contradict them, to ask them follow-up questions. And tell me that you don't live in an America with a media that, you know, would make Pravda blush. Here's Bob Taft, May 28th, 1950.
Spend anywhere from $1 billion.
Many more. Take your choice. You can live at home while you learn. And there's good pay for every hour spent in school. The National Guard commander in your city has all the details on how you can join your fellow citizens to build the peace with the new National Guard.
Senator, if you're ready, who has the first question? Mr. Lindley.
Senator, why have you opposed various important measures for checking the expansion of Soviet communist influence urged by Senator Vandenberg and other Republicans on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee?
Well, I don't know exactly which ones you're referring to. Sometimes I favored them because I thought they would be effective. In other cases, I'd opposed them because I thought they'd not be. Which ones are you worried about?
Well, first I'll take is the Atlantic Pact.
Well, I was against the Atlantic Pact because, as you see, it involves a program, a contract, in effect, by which we undertake to arm Europe and spend anywhere from $1 billion to $1.5 billion a year on a brand new program for arming Europe. I think perhaps the last time I was on this session, they spent most of the time on the question. I explained that I think for us to go out and arm half the world against the other half of the world is far more likely to bring a third world war than it ever is to bring peace. And I think we should not have undertaken any general arming of Europe. In particular cases, I'm quite willing to arm where the threat is immediate, obvious. But to start out on a 5-year program to arm Europe when you can't possibly get it done within 5 years, seems to me to just leave it open for Russia to feel, let's begin the war now, let's not wait until they're ready, because when they are ready, they're going to attack us. That seems to me, therefore, that the whole effect of this arms program is to increase the probability of war. And I think the one purpose of our foreign policy today should be to make the possibility of war less.
Mr. Spivak. Well,
Senator, you say that if the threat is immediate, we ought to arm. But couldn't that be too late?
Well, I don't... No, I don't think it's too late. It wasn't too late in Greece. It wasn't too late in Turkey. What I object to is undertaking, by contract, arm about 20 nations all around the world, all around Russia, obviously an aggressive move. We say defensive, but it's obviously could be used for aggression just as well. And it seems to me that it means an arms race. The Russians already have stepped up their arms production, their arms preparation, and the necessary result of every arms race in the history of the world has been war.
Well, Senator,
that's what we have stimulated by going out, not just arming ourselves to defend ourselves, but we're arming half the world.
Well,
against
Senator,
the other half of
them. Do you seriously think that we're not in an arms race today and that the Russians aren't arming at a rapid pace?
I think they're arming much more rapidly when we threaten them with a rapid increase in our arms. Mm-hmm. And the arms of all the people from the north, all the way from Norway on the north, all the way around every nation surrounding Russia to Iran on the south, obviously.
Well, Senator,
they're going to speed up their arms preparation just as much.
Well, Senator, I'd like to clarify this. We've been spending at the rate of about $15 billion a year in preparation. The Russians, for some years, I understand, have been spending more. Can there be any question in your mind but that there is an arms race on and that if we can effectively
help...
Well,
it's between ourselves and Russia, and we are in no sense an aggressor. As long as we confine ourselves here, Russia cannot possibly think we're an aggressor in any way. But if we go out to put modern divisions and American airplanes in every country surrounding Russia, then we have become an aggressor.
Well, do you think it's a mistake to have allies then and to help those allies prepare themselves for war?
I think exactly what I say. I think it's a great mistake for us to undertake to arm half the world against the other half the world, particularly as we have no assurance that they'll do any fighting or that they'll use our arms. We don't know what the French government will do when the war comes. We don't know whether the communists can take over in France. We don't know whether the communists can take over in Belgium. Do you think Belgium and Holland for 1 minute would defend themselves with the arms we give them if Russia notifies them that the next day they're going to drop an atom bomb on Holland or Belgium? The thing is not only stimulates war, it's a futile operation, in my opinion. It seems to me that it's perfectly obvious that we have no assurance that once those arms are delivered, they will be used for us. We have no assurance they won't be surrendered to the Russians. We have no assurance the communists won't take over those countries. It seems to me, besides being dangerous, it is may be an extremely futile operation.
What then is your answer? What then is your answer as far as armament is concerned?
I would not arm Europe. Let Europe work out its own solution. In my opinion, let us arm ourselves. Let us make... There's one thing that will deter Russia from war. And that is a strong American air force, a strong American supply of atomic bombs. That's the only thing that is going to deter Russia from an aggressive war. And in the last analysis in that war, they know that the winning of that war is going to depend on America. It's not going to depend on whether these other countries are armed or not armed. They're not the only thing that arming them, it does raise naturally a fear on the Russians that if they go on long enough, 5-10 years, and we go on spending billions and billions of dollars in arming them, the Russians may well feel someday they're going to attack Russia. And then you do have rather an incitement to the Russians to undertake this aggressive war we want to avoid than a deterrent.
Mrs. Craig.
Senator, are you in favor of former President Hoover's plan to reorganize the United Nations without the communists?
I don't think so, Miss Craig, no. I... I think this. I always felt that the Atlantic Pact was a great mistake. The original proposal of a group within the United Nations was made by Hamilton Fish Armstrong as a method of getting an ideal United Nations without a veto power within the big United Nations. Leave Russia out of that. It would be an inferior body. But if it worked, there might be reason to think the Russians would come in. And so I have been in favor of building up that, but I've never been in favor of trying to exclude the Russians from the United Nations, as Mr. Hoover proposed.
Mr. Finney.
Senator, I take it that you're a non-interventionist where Europe is concerned, but I'm not quite clear in my mind as to what sort of a program you might advocate in the Far East. With a lot of talk about the failure of an American policy in China, what alternative policy is advocated?
Of course, in Europe, while I'm no non-interventionist in Europe, Mr. Finney, I was in favor at the time of telling the Russians if they attack Western Europe, they'll find themselves at war with us.
Mm-hmm.
I'm willing to say that Russians, you can go so far and no further. And so also in the Far East, the policy is perfectly consistent. I would say that so far, no further. Formosa, you're not in Formosa today, don't go into Formosa.
How about Indochina?
I think very much the same. The only difficulty with Indochina is that can we do it? I mean, I think most of the rest of the Europe, I don't think the Russians are going to start a war if they understand our position, and they do. I'm not so sure about the Chinese communists in Indochina. They may do it anyway. They may not care whether they get into a war with us. And they may figure that we're not going to bother to go to war with communist China because they invade Indochina. So there it's more a question of practical effect. I think in principle it's the same. Yes, I would be in favor of helping Indochina, as I think we're proposing to do.
Well, would you intervene there militarily?
With our own soldiers?
Yes.
No, but I think I'd provide arms for them if they wish them, because they're right on the border and they have communists in their country, so that the threat is immediate. It is the next point where it looks as if there might be a communist aggression.
But isn't that the same pattern that you object to in Europe, that is, you're willing to Indo-Chinese?
I supported Greece and supported Turkey. There were practical places where the thing could be done. But this business of doing the whole world, I think it's too much for us. It's diffusing our resources. If we have a couple more, $2 or $3 billion to spend, let's increase our own army, our own air force.
Senator, I gather then that you're ready to go to war if Russia attacks any country in Western Europe.
That's correct.
Well, why do you want us to assume the sole burden of defending that area?
Because,
why do you
Mr.
object
Lindley,
to our having that shared by some of the people on the other side who want to share that task?
Because, Mr. Lindley, I think we're going to have to do it in the end anyway. And I think our reliance on these people and the diffusion of arms through Europe is just going to waste our resources. I don't think they're ever going to defend themselves, certainly not 5 or 10 years from now. I forget how long it's they say that themselves they'll have to be armed before they can defend themselves against Russia, but it's at least 5 years or 6 years.
Do you regard France as a weaker country than Greece, or Britain as a weaker country than Greece?
No, but I think that the French either will or will not succeed in defending themselves. And I think the Greeks, it turned out that we were able to keep the communists out of Greece because there was no... they had this internal situation of communists fighting within who probably would have taken over. In France, we gave them economic aid instead and enabled them to defeat their internal communists with ECAA.
Now, Senator, aid to Greece and Turkey, and yet they're just as close to the centers of Soviet power. And the same argument that you're making against helping to arm Europe was made against helping to arm Greece and Turkey, that it would provoke the Russians.
Except that one involves $200 million and the other involves $3 or $4 billion a year, ultimately, if we're going to do the job, which I say, I think is being thrown away as a practical matter. And incidentally, is rather inciting Russia to war. It makes war more probable, in my opinion.
Why does it make war more probable to rearm France than it did to rearm Turkey?
Oh, I don't think it does. But to rearm Norway, Belgium, Denmark, Germany, Austria, Italy, Greece, Iran, we're starting. All the countries around Europe makes war more likely because the Russians very naturally think they're building a great ring of armed forces around us. If we wait until that job is completed, they will move in on us.
Then your theory is...
They will, but I don't know whether they will or not. But I'm only saying that I think the Russian mentality is such that that is more likely to make them start this war. There's only one contingency on which we'll have a Third World War. And that is if the Russians decide that they want military aggression. They will engage in military aggression. What is going to make that more likely, and what is going to deter them? The one deterrent, in my opinion, is an American military force. And you can have help here and there where we feel that if we give the help, it will actually hold the Russians back.
Senator, you're not offering the world anything but another occupation and another liberation. Is that
Miss Craig, the last time I was on this thing, I said I'd never come again because you four people are debating with me. This is a press interview. If you want my opinion on things, you ought to take my opinion and then go on to some other subject.
I
didn't come here to debate with four of you on this question. I've told you what I think, and those reasons, it seems to me, are sound. I've written them in every magazine. They're there. I suggest you go on to some other
subject. This is my first question. I would like to have an answer to it.
Well, suppose, Mrs. Craig, we come back to your question in just a moment, give the Senator a breather here.
While our guest, Senator Robert Taft, and the panel of reporters indulge in a brief recess, here's a moment for a special message.
Joe's a chief petty officer, a mighty solid mate. He's retiring from the service, and he's only 38. Now his income will be steady for the rest of his life, and he'll start that little chicken farm along with his wife.
Let's go, Navy, yo, heave-ho. Let's go, Navy, the only way to go.
Oh, he joined up with the service at the age of 18. Got a raise right along in the years in between. There are men of nearly twice his age, their future's not secured. But from the day he joined the fleet, his future was assured.
Let's go, Navy, yo, heave-ho. Let's go, Navy, the only way to go.
Yes, for you young men, the peacetime Navy is a great life. If you are between the ages of 17 and 31, visit your nearest U.S. Navy recruiting station today.
Mrs. Craig, you want to pursue that question?
Well, I would like to ask it. If the Senator refuses to answer, well, then I'll go on to something else.
I've answered every question I know. What is the question, Miss Craig?
The question is, are you offering the world nothing but another occupation and liberation?
You're listening to Bob Taft on Meet the Press, May 28th, 1950, on his reasons for opposing the NATO Charter.
Frankly, I don't understand the question. I'm proposing that we go on as we're going, that we tell the Russians that if they start aggression, they're in war. In the meanwhile, that we go ahead and with the general development of the world, all of these countries are improving, they're getting stronger. Without having tremendous armies and air forces spread all over every little town in Europe.
Well, Senator, in short, you're not abandoning these other countries. You're simply saying that if somebody attacks them, we're going to war against the Russians.
That's
is
right.
that correct?
That's exactly. We're in war if the aggression if the Russians up to date have not undertaken any military aggression with Russian soldiers at least.
Do you think we're strong?
And I'm very hopeful that they may not do so.
Do you think we're strong enough to go to war today?
Oh, yes. We could be stronger.
Mrs. Craig.
Senator, I'd like now to turn from communism outside to communism inside. Do you agree with Attorney General McGrath that the FBI knows all the communists in this country and that they don't know any in the government service?
No, I think that's a ridiculous statement, Miss Craig. It's impossible that the government should know every communist in the government. And I don't think the FBI, I think you'd have a hard time getting that statement out of J. Edgar Hoover.
Well, what then is your opinion of the
McCarthy course, there is this. Everybody knows this, Miss Gregg, and perhaps that's an explanation of it. As I understand it, under the communist technique, as soon as anybody's employed by a government, he ceases automatically to be a member of the Communist Party. And consequently, the presumption is there are no members of the Communist Party in the government. But I think there's still communists, a lot of them.
What degree of approval do you give to the McCarthy charges? Could you tell us that?
Well, Senator McCarthy started his charges without asking me. I heard them and voted for the resolution to investigate. I'm in favor strongly of the resolution. That is, the committee ought to go into the whole problem. I think the question is raised. There's a prima facie case, so to speak, arising out of the Hiss conviction, out of the Wadley confession, out of the fact that in the Amerasia case, hundreds of State Department documents were in a pro-communist magazine, out of the fact that Mr. Sawyer today has dismissed Mr. Remington and Mr. Michael Lee because, obviously, of charges that they're too friendly to the communists. There's a prima facie case. There ought to be a complete investigation. And I would be in favor of having that investigation made. I don't think the committee has done it. And to the extent that Senator McCarthy is asking that it be done, I'm for him. As to his particular charges, I have no means of knowing whether they're right or not, and I never have backed up those charges.
Well, Senator, did you tell Senator McCarthy that if he couldn't make one case, to bring up another?
No, I never advised. He never asked my advice, and I never advised him.
Mr. Finney.
Senator Taft, you've got a political campaign down in Ohio, and there's talk that President Truman is threatening to come down there and stump your state. What effect do you think that might have on the outcome of it?
Well, I think it would have a pretty good effect for me, Mr. Finney. I'd be very glad to have the president come. Incidentally, in 38, when I ran the first time against Buckley, President Roosevelt came down and made a speech in Marietta. The general opinion was it was helpful to me rather than to Buckley.
When your Democratic opponent was in town the other day visiting at the White House, he made a prediction that he'd beat you by 250,000 votes. Are you willing to put a prediction on the record here today?
I'm not ready yet for a prediction. I can only say this, that 99% of the people in Ohio who venture to predict disagree with Mr. Ferguson, not only as to the amount of the votes, but as to the result of the outcome. But as to the exact amount until we get more accurate figures, I can't make a prediction.
Mr. Spivak.
Senator, what effect do you think the primary victories of Senator Moss and Governor Duff are going to have on the Republican Party in 1952? They're both known as progressives in the party.
Well, I don't know that everything of that sort has some effect, although I think most of the issues are personal. Wayne Morse is I think, popular in Oregon, and he won largely because he's Wayne Morse, not solely because of his views. Governor Duff, also the same thing in Pennsylvania. I think Governor Duff, as far as I know, has views are fairly much like mine, at least on domestic questions. I haven't examined his foreign
Well, Senator, why did you think that the nomination of Senator Morse and Governor Duff were local issues, but when Senator Pepper lost his primary, you said, and I quote, "I believe the Florida vote indicates the attitude in other states."
Because that was the issue there. You see, in Florida, you had almost exactly the issue we have in the nation. In as far as I know, the issue in Oregon may have been, I don't know what it was, but there was no national publicity about it that would affect the party. I think it was largely, as I say, in that case, personal. Some cases personal, some not. In the case of Governor Duff and Mr. Grundy, I don't know that there was any such issue as there was in Florida. Governor Duff wasn't advocating the Brannon Plan. He wasn't advocating the universal compulsory health insurance. He wasn't advocating more spending.
Wasn't there an
issue?
He
wasn't advocating repeal of the Taft-Hartley Law. In fact, he's against repeal of the Taft-Hartley Law. So there was no such issue. In fact, the Governor Duff's position, as far as stated, I think was very much the same as Representative Smathers rather than Senator Pepper.
Well, wasn't there a major issue, though, of progressivism against reactionaryism in Pennsylvania?
Well, what's that? I don't think there is any such thing. I see it. Progressivism against reactionism. What kind of an issue is that? I mean, it seems to me you're for certain things or you're against them. I would say the issue was largely a question, as I've said before, of maintaining a free system or having a socialistic system with federal control. That was the issue in Florida. It was not the issue in Pennsylvania. Again, the issue was largely personal as far as I could see, and certainly Governor Duff is very much, as far as I know, he seems to be right in line with the general Republican position, just as much prepared to battle President Truman on that issue, and his contest is not is going to be with Representative Myers.
Well, how
who represents Trumanism.
How do you
Governor Duff's on the Republican side.
If what you say is so, how do you explain the fact that President Truman invited Senator Duff or Governor Duff into the Democratic Party?
Well, because these Democrats bring about the idea that the Republicans are divided, and that Governor Duff is on his side. He isn't. Governor Duff's position, as I say, as far as I know, is right in line with the.
Well,
the general position
they
of the Republicans, of course, he's not in any way. There are some reactionary Republicans, I think, perhaps. I've met some.
What do you mean by reactionary, but, Senator? I thought
I mean,
there was no such
opposed,
thing as reactionary.
Those who are opposed to any. Those who are opposed to any new thing of any kind is a reactionary. A fellow who says, I want exactly what we've got, or go back to something we had before, I suppose can be said to be a reactionary. A man who is willing to consider changes in the light of their merits is a liberal, I would say. I think that's the line as I see it.
Senator, I tell you...
He doesn't have to be a socialist for that reason. He doesn't have to be for regulating all the farmers. He doesn't have to be for abolishing the freedom of the medical profession and spending $6 billion of federal money running every medical service in the United States. Governor Duff, it seems to me, as I say, is as far as I know, I would agree with his position on practically everything that he is that I've read of what he has said to say.
Mr. Finney.
Senator, I wanted to ask you what you think about the new General Motors UAW contract, particularly the fact that apparently the company has agreed there that it will not use the Taft-Hartley, do any of the things that it could do under the Taft-Hartley Act for 5 years against the union.
I don't know that provision. What was it? I didn't see that particular feature of it. I didn't know.
Well, it's in the union shop, the modified union shop agreement that's part of the contract. Otherwise,
the Taft-Hartley Act permits the union shop. I don't know that the General Motors agreed to refrain from use of the Taft-Hartley law. I don't think so.
What is your general reaction to that?
To the whole contract? No. Well, I thought the 5-year contract was a tremendous step forward to have it for 5 years. The General Motors also incorporated a new provision on the theory that they could pretty well guarantee for 5 years an increase in productivity.
Mm-hmm.
The rate of 4%, or no, 4 cents a year, it's a little less than 4%. Maybe two and a half percent.
Yeah.
That they could guarantee that and promise that the wages would increase in accordance with that increase in productivity. The only question I had about it at all, Mr. Finney, was this. If in each company where they increase the productivity, the management of labor in that particular business take all of the advantage of that productivity, where's the poor old consumer come in? How do we spread this advantage in general productivity to the fellows that are working in ditches and other places where there isn't much chance for an increase in productivity. I wondered whether the General Motors contract, possibly they've allowed for some decrease in the price of automobiles besides what the management and the labor people are taking in that particular industry. I hope they have, but I was a little doubtful when I saw the contract.
Senator Craig, I'm not sure I'm...
For 5 elections, the people have refused the Republicans. Why do
I'm
you
not,
think...
Mrs. Craig, it isn't fair to let you continue that because our time is up. I hate to interrupt. This concludes the latest edition of Meet the Press. Thank you, Senator Taft, for being with us. We'll hear about next week's guest in just a moment.
Boy, that sounds good. That's a good way to end that song, guys, with the guy puking. All right, this is Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. You're listening to Chaos Radio, 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. If anybody wants to call and get involved in the show, last 10 minutes here, 646-6446, 646-6446. If you're listening out of town online, 512-646-6446. And, boy, what the hell is wrong with Americans, man? How did they pick Ike Eisenhower over Robert Taft? I just can't understand it. You know, I'm not a big fan of William Howard Taft, and Robert Taft was far from perfect. Not quite a Ron Paul complete non-interventionist. But you heard his opposition there to the NATO charter. This is only going to make it more likely that we have a war with Russia. And of course, that's still the case as we continue to expand NATO up to the very porch of Russia. This Atlantic Charter that was supposedly defensive, this NATO Charter, not the Atlantic Charter, the NATO Charter that supposedly was to protect Europe and to protect America from that Soviet bear. Well, now the Soviet Union's gone, and now who's the Soviet Union? Who's the one marching its modern Warsaw Pact up to the border of its enemies? It's the United States of America. And meanwhile, Meet the Press has turned into a Pravda-like show where you will never, ever, ever see a panel of reporters pointing their fingers and asking questions of politicians like this. Ever. I mean, can you imagine Dick Cheney's many appearances on Meet the Press in the run-up to war? What that would have been like if Jonathan Landay from Knight Ridder newspapers had been allowed to say, well, but yeah, everyone I talk to says that those aluminum tubes couldn't possibly be used for a centrifuge, Mr. Cheney. So who's lying? Every centrifuge expert in the Western Hemisphere or you? But no, instead we got Tim Russert, who just feels so good just being that close to Dick Cheney that he doesn't care what lie Dick Cheney says, and he never asks a follow-up, ever. Does Tim Russert, God, boy, listen to me. I hate Tim Russert, obviously. Listen to me, man. I'm freaking over here. Meet the Press now is no better than if it was produced by the Soviets. Meet the Press, which you just heard from March 28th, 1950, a panel of, what, four or five reporters grilling Senator Bob Taft, is now no better at all than you would expect to hear on Pravda during the bad old days of the Soviet Union. Absolutely unforgivable. And in fact, here's a clip from Meet the Press where Colin Powell actually says something impressive, and you'll notice the lack of reporters following up on his statements, but this is worth listening to, so check this out. This is Colin Powell on Meet the Press yesterday.
Guantanamo. The torture. When John McCain was seeking ways to deal with the issue of torture, you wrote him a letter and said this, quote, the world is beginning to doubt the moral basis of our fight against terrorism.
Right.
What do you mean?
They are. Guantanamo has become a major problem for America's perception, as it seemed, the way the world perceives America. And if it was up to me, I would close Guantanamo, not tomorrow, but this afternoon. I'd close it. And I would not let any of those people go. I would simply move them to the United States and put them into our federal legal system. The concern was, well, then they'll have access to lawyers. Then they'll have access to writs of habeas corpus. So what? Let them. Isn't that what our system's all about? And by the way, America, unfortunately, has 2 million people in jail, all of whom had lawyers and access to writs of habeas corpus. And so we can handle bad people with our system. And so I would get rid of Guantanamo, and I'd get rid of the military commission system and use established procedures in federal law or in the manual for courts martial. I would do that because I think it's a more equitable way to do it, and it's more understandable in constitutional terms. But I'll also do it because every morning I pick up a paper, and some authoritarian figure, some person somewhere, is using Guantanamo to hide their own misdeeds. And so essentially we have shaken the belief that the world had in America's justice system by keeping a place like Guantanamo open and creating things like the military commission. We don't need it, and it's causing us far more damage than any good we get for it. But remember what I started in this discussion saying, don't let any of them go. Put them into a different system, a system that is experienced, that knows how to handle people like this.
Yeah, don't let any of them go until they're acquitted because they're innocent. How many hundreds of people, is it 300-something people now have been released from Guantanamo Bay? Are you like me in that you wonder what the hell they were doing there in the first place if now they're innocent and set free? Or is that just me? But you heard Colin Powell, that un-American, you know, America-hating leftist traitor to our leader, the president. They're saying, I wouldn't close Guantanamo tomorrow. I'd close it this afternoon. I'd close it immediately. And why? Why? Because every dictator in the world, from Robert Mugabe to the Politburo in China to the Grand Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, can point to Guantanamo Bay and say, at least we're not as bad as the Americans, where we all know they're torturing people, where we all know they kidnap and hold people without any benefit of law whatsoever. At least we're not like those Nazis. That's the claim that thugs like Mugabe and Khamenei and the Politburo in China and the rest of these people can now invoke. Well, at least we're not like the Americans. President Putin of Russia gave a press conference this weekend where he said, boy, did you see the Amnesty International report about what's going on over there in North America? Thank you. You're so polite, Mr. Putin, for not being specific. But we all know it ain't Mexico and Canada that's torturing, you know, kidnapping, torturing, and murdering people, giving them trials that would have been laughed out of the Soviet Union. We know who in North America is doing that. It's us. It's America. It's the country that believes in its principles so much that it can't even recognize when it's completely destroyed them. Yeah, there's Mr. Dignity, Colin Powell, telling you what most of the time you can only hear on Radio Chaos. It's not okay for America to have gulags. It's not okay for our government to kidnap and torture and murder people outside the law. In fact, there is no way to torture people inside the law. You can put them to death. You can murder them in this country on the federal level and in most states, I think. But no, torture, that's against the law. See, it says it right there, rule number 8. No cruel and unusual punishment allowed, period. That's the law. But there you have it. Colin Powell, speaking the truth. Colin Powell on Meet the Press with no follow-up question, with no reporters to nail him down and make him be specific. Just Tim Russert, the world's biggest pushover, sitting there. As Colin Powell says, I wouldn't close Guantanamo tomorrow. I'd close it this morning. I'd close it right now, said Colin Powell. But nobody's going to listen to him. Robert Gates agrees, of course, the Secretary of Defense. Told George Bush, you can read all about this, just do some Googling. I don't have the article right in front of me. But George Bush told him, oh yeah, closing Guantanamo, yeah, we want to do that. And Robert Gates made the mistake of taking Bush seriously and started making plans to close Guantanamo. Cheney and Alberto Gonzalez, the Attorney General, and George Bush overruled him. And of course we know why, because they're all guilty of kidnapping and torture and murder. All of which are federal felonies. All of which carry death penalties. And so, to admit that they've been keeping these people outside the law, and that a change has to be made would be to admit guilt in conspiracy to kidnap, torture, and murder people. That's right. The Attorney General of the United States is guilty of conspiracy to kidnap, torture, and murder people. And so's the Vice President, and so's the President. So when they told Gates, oh yeah, let's look into closing Guantanamo, and he took them seriously, they went, no, we were just saying that. We can't close Guantanamo until we, you know, get in our escape pod and get the hell out of here. Otherwise, we'll have to admit that we're all guilty of conspiracy to kidnap, torture, and murder people. And you know how Americans are. You know, we're strict constructionists when it comes to law and order. Well, okay, when it comes to people who aren't government employees. Government employees can torture and murder whoever they want. We all know that. All right, folks, this is Anti-War Radio. It has been. See you back here tomorrow, 11 to 1 Texas time.
Come, you masters of war. You that build the big guns. You that build the death planes. You that build all the bombs. You that hide behind walls. You that hide behind disks. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes. And you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won. You want me to believe, but I see through your eyes, and I see through your brain, like I see through the water that runs down my drain. You fasten all the triggers for the others to fire. And then you sit back and watch when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion while the young people's blood flows out of their bodies and is buried in the mud. You've thrown the worst fear that can ever be hurled. Fear to bring children into the world. Before threatening my baby, unborn and unnamed. You ain't worth the blood that runs in your veins. How much do I know but to talk out of turn? You might say that I'm young. You might say I'm unlearned. But there's the one thing I know. I'm younger than you. Even Jesus would never forgive what you do. Let me ask you one question. Is your money that good? Or will it buy you forgiveness? Do you think that it could? I think you will find when your death takes its toll, All the money you made will never buy back your soul. And I hope that you die. And your death will come soon. I'll follow your casket by the pale afternoon. I'll watch while you're lowered down to your deathbed. And I'll stand over your grave till I'm sure that you're dead.